A whole hour. It's not enough. Good to see you folks again tonight. Well, let me see. We made it to Joshua chapter 22 this morning. Let's go back there. There's another incredible story that we kick off from in Joshua chapter 22. Remember that the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh had their inheritance on the east side of the Jordan River. Now, there weren't a whole lot of bridges around back then, especially in a land that was undeveloped, that they just got to, and the only way they were able to get across the water as a nation was for God to part the water like He did the Red Sea, and they went across then on that dry land, which of course just absolutely terrified the kings of the Canaan land over there, because they knew whoever's in charge of them did miracles, you see. Well, the problem, too, was that the altar of sacrifice was not in Jerusalem. That was there when finally they built the temple. During this period of time, the altar of sacrifice was in Shiloh, which is a ways from Jerusalem and over some even more difficult terrain to get to. So in order to, shall we say, go and make sacrifices, it was quite a deal. A very difficult one for these who lived on the east side of the Jordan. Well, they figured something out that sort of upset everybody on the west side of the Jordan to begin with, and it almost started a war. Let's read about it. Verse 10. And they came, when they came to the region of the Jordan, which is in the land of Canaan, the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh built an altar there by the Jordan. A great, impressive altar. Whoa, I wonder what that looked like. Now, you know, God had given them instructions that any altars they built for Him had to be out of natural stone. He says, I don't want you to lay an axe to it. I don't want you to put a chisel to it. No carving on this. No carving of your names. Kilroy was here or something. No, only the work that I have done is to be in my altars. So anyone that they built would had to have been just simply collected rocks as God had laid them out on the land, and Israel has quite a few rocks. In fact, one of my rabbi friends here in Los Angeles, I'm sure he's gone on now, but I really liked the guy, and he told me they had a legend that an angel was sent by God to collect the rocks from the ground where the farmers could farm, you see, because rocks will just tear up a plow. And so this angel had this huge backpack, and he's collecting all the rocks. And when he got to Israel, he stumbled. And when you go there, you think, yes, he did. Plenty of rocks. You could build an altar at the snap of a finger out of what God had put together. But they built an impressive altar. Now, it must have looked like the altar that would have been now there at Shiloh, where the sacrifices would have taken place. Well, there was only one altar where such sacrifices would be made. And here the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh had built another very impressive altar. It almost would make them think, whatever you can do, we can do better. Well, let's keep reading. Now the children of Israel heard someone say, behold, the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, and half tribe of Manasseh have built an altar on the frontier of the land of Canaan, in the region of the Jordan, on the children of Israel's side. And when the children of Israel heard of it, the whole congregation of the children of Israel gathered together at Shiloh to go to war against them. Then the children of Israel sent Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the priest of the children of Reuben, to the children of Gad, and to the half-tribe of Manasseh, and to the land of Gilead, and with him 10 rulers, one ruler each from the chief house of every tribe of Israel, and each one was the head of the house of his father among the divisions of Israel. These were top dudes, by the way. He didn't send some, undersecretary of an undersecretary. These were the top dudes. Then they came, verse 15, to the children of Reuben, to the children of Gad, and to the half-tribe of Manasseh, to the land of Gilead. And they spoke with them, saying, thus says the whole congregation of the Lord, what treachery is this that you have committed against the God of Israel, to turn away this day from following the Lord, and that you have built for yourselves an altar that you might rebel this day against the Lord? Is the iniquity of Peor not enough for us, from which we are not cleansed till this day, although there was a plague in the congregation of the Lord? But that you must turn away this day from following the Lord? And it shall be, if you rebel today against the Lord, that tomorrow he will be angry with the whole congregation of Israel. In other words, you're going to get us all killed. Nevertheless, if the land of your possession is unclean, then cross over to the land of the possession of the Lord, where the Lord's tabernacle stands, and take possession among us. But do not rebel against the Lord, nor rebel against us by building yourselves an altar besides the altar of the Lord your God. Now, they're not through giving evidence against this altar. Listen to this. Did not Achan the son of Zerah commit a trespass in the accursed thing, and wrath fell on all the congregation of Israel? And that man did not perish alone in his iniquity. Boy, this is a pretty tough indictment, isn't it? You guys are doing a horrible thing, and you're going to get us all killed as a result of it. Now, have you ever, I don't need to ask you this, have you ever thought you knew what was going on and found out you didn't? Have you ever made an accusation and then you just felt like, as my mother used to put it, 2 cents waiting on change? When you discover that your accusation, your assumption, your conclusions were totally wrong. I got to tell you a story right quick. There was a... the Lord has taught me a lot about the way he deals with people and the way he deals with me. I worked once with a guy that I just automatically didn't like him. Have you ever had that kind of thing happen? It wasn't that he had done anything bad toward me, but there's just some people you just automatically come to a conclusion, I don't like him. Now, part of the problem with this guy is he kind of walked like he was going to hit you, You can't trust people like that. You know what I mean? And one day I was preaching in a church in New York. And after the service, the pastor and his wife invited me over to the parsonage to eat with them, which I was willing to do. I do eat a lot. And in the course of the meal, she asked me, "Do you know so-and-so?" And she named this guy. I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Well, now what do you say when, they ask if you know this guy you don't like?" She said, "Did you know that he was a nephew of mine?" "No, ma'am, I didn't know that." And then she said, "Do you know his story?" "No, I don't." She said, "When he was just a small child, he contracted a fatal disease, and he lingered at death's door. And oh, we prayed for him and prayed for him, and God performed a miracle and restored him to life." And she said, "The only thing that even remains as something for him to remember what God put him through and how he saved his life is the way he walks." Now, that's 2 cents waiting on change again, Well, that was the case with this particular situation. You see, God had given the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh rest. It says in verse 21, then the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, and half-tribe of Manasseh answered and said to the heads of the divisions of Israel, the Lord God of gods, the Lord God of gods, He knows. And let Israel itself know if it is in rebellion or if in treachery against the Lord, then do not save us this day. In other words, if we're doing what you say we're doing, let God kill us right now. That's what he's saying. If we have built ourselves an altar to turn from following the Lord, or if to offer on it burnt offerings or grain offerings, or if to offer peace offerings on it, let the Lord himself require an account. But in fact, we have done it for fear, for a reason, saying, in time to come, your descendants may speak to our descendants, what have you to do with the Lord God of Israel? In other words, hey, you guys on the east side of Jordan, you're not part of us. What do you have to do with all of what we're doing over here? For the Lord has made the Jordan, the river, a border between you and us. You children of Reuben and children of Gad, you have no part in the Lord. That would be what they would be saying. They're the guys. So your descendants would make our descendants cease fearing the Lord. Wow. Therefore, we said, let us now prepare to build ourselves an altar, not for burnt offering nor for sacrifice, but that it may be a witness between you and us and our generation after us, that we may perform the service of the Lord before him with our burnt offerings and our sacrifices, with our peace offerings, that your descendants may not say to our descendants in time to come, you have no part in the Lord. Therefore, we said it'll be when they say this to us or to our generations in time to come, that we may say, here is the replica of the altar of the Lord which our fathers made, though not for burnt offerings nor for sacrifices, but it is a witness between you and us. Wow, how different. We built this just to make sure we would always have this altar in our minds. We built this so that you would know we're on your side. We built this so you could even look at it and our kids could look at it and say, we are followers of the real, true God of God, King of kings and Lord of lords. Therefore, we said that it will be when they say to us, or our generation in time to come, that we may say, here's a replica of the altar. It's a witness between you and us. For far be it from us that we should rebel against the Lord and turn from following the Lord this day to build an altar for burnt offerings, for grain offerings, or for sacrifices beside the altar of the Lord our God, which is before his tabernacle. Now, when Phinehas the priest and the rulers of the congregation, the heads of the divisions of Israel who were with him, heard the words that the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, and the children of Manasseh spoke, it pleased them. Then Phinehas, you know, that's kind of nice to have something diplomatically happen that pleases you, isn't it? I don't know about you, but when I read about all the diplomacy that's going on right now in the world, it doesn't seem to be working a whole lot, does it? And we don't find much in there that says, well, our chief one met with their chief one, and they said, oh, we're so sorry. We'll be glad to do what you ask. You know, you never read that because it doesn't seem to happen. But this one happened pretty good. I like that. Then Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the priest, said to the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, and the children of Manasseh, this day we perceive that the Lord is among us, because you have not committed this treachery against the Lord. Now, you have delivered the children of Israel out of the hand of the Lord. In other words, whew, God's not going to kill us after all. That's what they were saying. And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the priest, and the rulers returned from the children of Reuben and the children of Gad, from the land of Gilead to the land of Canaan, to the children of Israel, and brought back word to them. So the thing pleased the children of Israel, and the children of Israel blessed God. They spoke no more of going against them in battle to destroy the land where the children of Reuben and Gad dwelt. The children of Reuben and the children of Gad called the altar witness. For it is a witness between us that the Lord is God. Wow. What a beautiful story. First, they built it. It was impressive. They just failed to tell the other guys ahead of time what they were doing. And then when they rose up against it and then went over and found out, hey, it's not what you think. We are doing this so we won't forget. We're not going to have any sacrifices on this. This is just an altar to remind us who the Lord is and whom we serve. We're doing all of our sacrifices over at the tabernacle. You don't need to worry about it. Now, altars are interesting things. Sometimes people who worship different idolic deities will build an altar, even in their home, and have little idols and things of that sort. And they will make sacrifices on that altar to that idol. But it seems that altars in the Bible, except for the altar of sacrifice, were always built as memorials. They were always built just to remind themselves, and then of course us, because all of this was written for us, that God had done a remarkable thing in their lives. You know, Noah, after the flood, built an altar. Why? Because he wanted this to be something to cause us all to remember what God had done. Abraham seemed to build a number of altars. There were a lot of different places that were markers to help us remember what God did in that place, you see. Beth-El, where Jacob used a stone for a pillow. And in my travels, I think I've had some pillows like that. But he has this incredible dream, and it becomes a place of an altar, a place to remember, you see. These are memorial kinds of things. Do you realize that when we take communion, it's an altar? Why? Because Jesus said, do this to remember me, you see? So it becomes, in a way, a rather active altar for us to use to remember him. My wife and I, when we're at home, tend to have communion together every morning. Now, sometimes you might think, well, can you do that, you know? Don't you have to be a pastor to lead that? Jesus never said that. He just said, do it as oft as you do to remember me. And we like to remember him. It's as simple as that. And it's a good way, if you have trouble praying with your wife, to sort of naturally go into a time of prayer after you've taken communion. But it's a memorial for us. We remember God, and we want to do it as often as we can. There are a number of things like that that even God set up that you could almost call an altar, but it's a different sort. Let's go back to Deuteronomy. Just turn left from Joshua and go over one book. Chapter 6. Let me just start reading with the first verse and read down to verse 9. Now, this is the command. This is Moses, by the way, talking to the children of Israel. This is the commandment, and these are the statutes and judgments which the Lord your God has commanded to teach you, that you may observe them in the land which you are crossing over to possess. That you may fear the Lord your God, to keep all his statutes and his commandments, which I command you, you and your son and your grandson, all the days of your life, and that your days may be prolonged. Therefore, hear, O Israel, and be careful to observe it. Let me sort of say, be careful to remember it, to memorialize it. That it may be well with you, that you may multiply greatly as the Lord, the God of your fathers, has promised you, a land flowing with milk and honey. Now, the next words we're going to read is what's commonly called the Great Shema. It was a thing that every obedient Israeli home would start the day with their family, repeating this that is called the Great Shema. Shema. Now, keep in mind that the word Shem in Hebrew means name. So they were just sort of expressing what the name of the Lord is to them and how they are to honor it. And here's what they would say every day. It was a great creed, by the way. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. There you go. That's it. Simple. Do you recall that when someone asked Jesus, what is the great commandment? You know, what's the biggie, Jesus? What does God want us to do? And what did he say? Big commandment is, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength and so forth. And he says, and the second one was just like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. Now that was a new one for them, see. And one of the reasons Jesus would have said that was because they didn't believe anyone was their neighbor. The Pharisees didn't, except other Pharisees. They really hated the Samaritans, for instance, because they didn't think the Samaritans were even really human beings. Therefore, why should we treat them anything different from animals? And then Jesus, you know, when he says that, they will, who is my neighbor? You guy asks. And I bet he wished afterward he hadn't asked that. Because Jesus launches into what we call the story of the Good Samaritan. Not the good Pharisee, not even the good Israeli, but the good Samaritan. So Jesus had introduced a whole new thing to their thinking, and it was not nationalistic. I don't want to get into that tonight. Maybe some other sermon just before I die so you can't kill me anyway. Then he says these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You know, that's not a bad thing for us to kind of remember, is it then, if it's to be in our hearts? Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Let's say that. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And now let's do the next verse. You shall love the Lord your God. Let's say that. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your soul, and with all your strength, with all your strength. Not a bad thing to say every morning. So this is to be in our hearts. And then he says, you shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house. All right, that covers one time. When you walk by the way. Okay, that covers sort of the rest of the time. And when you rise up, or when you lie down, and when you rise up. Now, what other time is left? That's kind of it, isn't it? What he's saying is, make God talk your talk of the day. Now, it really, in terms of, and I'm not putting this down because I enjoy football. But it's not going to matter in terms of eternity whether UCLA or USC ever wins another game. It's not going to matter whether the Diamondbacks or the Rockies win the World Series. You know, God really isn't thinking, oh, what's going to happen? I doubt that God's all that concerned about the World Series. We just are, that's all. I have a feeling, well, you know, you've seen the billboards, and I had a little bit to do with those, but some of the things that they said on these billboards, I really wish they hadn't. And one of them, God, you know, they're quoting God, and he says, if you'll quit cursing, I'll make the commute shorter. I don't think God's really all that concerned about the commute. Actually, you know what? That's a good prayer time. You ought to be praying, God, save me. Don't let me die. But sometimes I find in this day and age about the only private time I have is when I'm driving. It's a great time just to be praying, you know, and just talking to the Lord. I'm a guy that gets really upset if some dude in front of me is doing 3.25 miles an hour and the light's about to change to red in front of me and I can't get around him. And I'll sit there. He makes it. And I'm sitting there grousing, you know, oh boy, I'm losing a whole 60 seconds here, you know. Until finally the Lord spoke to my heart and said, Erwin, knock it off. I just saved your life. If you had have made this light, you'd have been killed in the next block. Oh, okay, thank you. In fact, while you're sitting here, rather than complain, why don't we talk? Well, that's a quaint thought. So at any rate, what I think the Lord wants us to do is talk about Him all day. Now, that's a great memorial. I have to confess to you that, you know, my wife and I have four children, and devotionals at our house have not been traditional, let's put it that way. It's been too chaotic at our house to have very many traditional devotions. But we listened to this verse, and so we made our day a God talk kind of day. And sometimes it was in strange ways. We might be driving along as a family when they were young, you know. And I'll just drive over a bridge and I'll honk at it and I'll say, thank you, Jesus. You know, Dad, what happened? What's up? Well, we just crossed a bridge. Well, I bet nobody's ever crossed this bridge and said, thank you, Jesus, when they did. Oh, our dad is strange. But in summer times, as we would journey, when I taught at the college, the university, and I'd have camps and retreats scheduled all over the United States, and we would load up our van as a family and camp all over the United States on the way to these different places of ministry. And we loved to camp in national parks. But, you know, national parks, campgrounds fill up by 11 a.m. And we were always faithful to get there at 5 p.m. And as we would approach it, we'd say, okay, kids, we need to pray that God will give us a place to stay. Okay, Daddy, and we'd pray. And we'd drive past the sign that said campground full and wander around, and sure enough, there was the perfect place. And we'd jump out and start setting up our tent, man. And someone would come over and said, man, there were some people that had that place just a few minutes ago decided they were going to leave. We don't understand it. We do. And in all of our journeys, and California camps, you know, the state parks, they take reservations. So if you're not in on it the first day, just about forget it. But we would stop at California campgrounds and we'd pray, you know, the kids would pray, and we'd drive up to the sign that said campground full, and I'd say to the person in the booth, I bet your sign doesn't mean what it says. I said, how did you know? I mean, just before you drove up, I took a cancellation off the fax machine. And so it became that almost every campground was just a memorial to us, an altar, if you please, of what God had done. And we just talked about the Lord all day long. It was the conversation, thanking Him for who He was and what He had done in our life. But that's not all He says to do. He says, bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. Now, those are two very significant places for a Jewish person. Your hand was a sign of your strength, which is why sometimes hands would be cut off, because it means then you couldn't make a living, you see. And in a way, he's saying, let your work even represent the law. Let it represent the things of God. Bind it to your hand, your head, your forehead. And if you go to Israel, there at the Wailing Wall, you'll see them with a thing bound to their hand and wrapped around and so forth. And also a little box bound to their foreheads and the like. Phylacteries, they call them. And he says, you know, your forehead to them was a symbol of your highest powers. Your ability to make judgments. Keep my law right there, what he was saying. And in a sense, he's saying, just keep my law close to what you think and close to what you do at all times. Write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. Now, I want to sort of bring a modern application to this that I hope you'll think of it as neat as I do. If you were here this morning, you recall that we had a root beer color shirt. Now I'm thinking a lady named it that. Because guys don't know root beer. It's just brown. And you women invented taupe and lavender and things like that, you know. Okay, there's red, black, blue, green, brown. What else we have? But you see, these shirts that we wear, in a way, you know, your Christian t-shirts and the things that you put on the walls of your house and so forth become little signpost hangers, things that maybe are obeying what God says to do, to keep yourself reminded of who you serve. I recall in my house when I was a kid, there was always a sign in the dining room that said this. Just they hung it right there in the dining room. Jesus Christ is the Lord of this house. He is the silent listener to every conversation. He is the unseen guest at every meal. Now, you see, I remember it. I have other things hanging in my house. Not my clothes. I don't hang them. I'm a guy. You know where they go. My wife helps me with that. But this was something I remember. It's one of those signposts hung there. Maybe you put a fish symbol or a dove or something like that on the bumper of your car. Fine. It's kind of a memorial. Help you remember, if nothing else, how to drive. So you won't embarrass God. You know? But there are all kinds of memorials like that that we carry around. Little altar things, you might say, that remind us of who God is and what He has told us to do. If you go to Israel, on every doorpost, you will find a little kind of semicircular thing nailed to the side of the door facing that they called a mezuzah. And in it is a rolled up scroll of the Ten Commandments or some part of the law. And everyone, when they go in, they'll touch that as they go in as kind of... Probably they don't even know what it says in there. But it is a tradition of theirs. And I have yet to see a doorpost, even in places where they maybe don't even believe in God, and yet they have that mezuzah there on the doorpost. Here is what he's saying. Well, we would put up something different. Maybe a dove, maybe a fish symbol, something of that sort. But he's just saying, make the symbols of me, the memorials of me, the little altars, if you please, so common that you cannot escape them, that you talk about me all day and that you hang things on your doorpost and you put them on your wall and you even wear them maybe. And maybe you have a cross hanging around your neck. It's a little memorial, you see. Or maybe you have a pen of some sort that causes you to remember who you belong to. It's all well and good. It's a memorial, you see. And I have come to the conclusion that in our modern day, though we don't go out and build those kinds of altars that the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh did, or that they put there for the sacrifices at the tabernacle, each of us have moments of memorial or items of memorial that cause you to remember what God has done in your life. Let me tell you about a few of mine. If you have visited my table, and this isn't a commercial here, and see the books that have been written that I feel God has given me, in a very interesting way, they are a memorial about something that's very precious to me. Let me start by telling you a long back story. I'm a high school senior. I look younger than now. I'm trimmer than now, 169 pounds, according to the football program. You know, quite a specimen. But God had blessed me, and I had, you know, kind of been heavily in school activity, and I was president of every student body I was a part of, and you know, president of every club I was a part of. It's just the way God had put things together for me. And then I ended up being governor of Mississippi Boys State, and this is the commercial. It's all about me, you know. And a bunch of things like that. And as a result, there was a youth magazine, a national Christian youth magazine, that featured me in February of 1956 as their youth of the month, you know. Well, it so happened that there was a young lady up in Ripley, Tennessee, who subscribed to that magazine. And when she read that, and that was only 150 miles away from where I lived, and she saw those pictures. Ma'am, don't laugh. And read that story. You know how it is. Thump, 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 thump. And she did something that girls back then just didn't do. And she said to me, and I believe her, that if she had thought she would have ever seen me, she would never have written a letter. But she wrote me a letter and said, since we are youth leaders in the same basic area, perhaps we can exchange ideas about youth work. Well, we did. And we exchanged photographs then. She sent me the awfulest photograph. And I asked her why. She said, well, why waste a good one on you? I didn't think I'd ever see you. On Thanksgiving Day of that same year, I'm a college freshman. I had played football my first year of college and got my back cracked in four places and wrinkled in three others in the last game of the year. It laid me up in the hospital for a week. And by that point, we had met and had gotten a bit serious. And she hadn't heard from me for that whole week, which was unusual. And she called down there and found out I was in the hospital. She jumped on a bus and rode 200 miles down to Jackson, Mississippi, where I was in the hospital to see me. And I thought, you know, she needs to get married. So Thanksgiving Day of 1956, I'm in a brace in Memphis, Tennessee. I asked Ada Faye Brown to marry me. And she said yes. 1 year later, Thanksgiving of 1957... we got married. Now, any of you mathematicians, put this together now. That was 1957. This is 2007. Thanksgiving Day, about a month from now, I will celebrate, 50 years of marriage, you see. So you can congratulate me, and when you see her out there, give her your condolences. Now, I tell you all of that to tell you something else that's very important that a lot of people don't realize. She happens to be an extremely capable person. She even has a master's degree in business administration. And I told her, you know, if you'd make me a good living, I would make you a good husband. Then she wondered, out of what? But anyway, one of her incredible skills is English. She just has a master control of that. And what most people do not know, you know, is that a success of a book depends to a great extent on how well it is edited. Nothing will turn it from first class into third and fourth class, worse than a lot of typos and a lot of, oh man, that was grammatically incorrect. Why weren't they thinking, you know? And she is the one who edits everything that I write. Now, what this means, and that's been a source of some tension, I must say, at times. But every time I look at a book that I've written, it is a memorial to me, not just of what God has given to me to write, but of who He has given to me. And it was a miracle that God sent her to me. She was a real gift of God. And so everything that I have written, I look at it and I realize, this lady that you gave me, God, her hand, her fingerprints are on this book. And it's a memorial to me of what God in His love for me did in my life, you see. I hope that your relationships, your marriage will have memorial to it in some way where you can say, I see your hand in my life, God, by what you have given me and who you have given me. There are other little altars of my life that I want to tell you about. And even as I do, I want you to think about the altars of your life. We have four children. One of those daughters of ours kind of pressed against the edges. Now, I don't know if you've ever had a child that did that. And one day when I returned home and my wife met me at LAX, I was just coming back from India. She handed me a letter from our youngest daughter because she had disappeared and had left a letter saying that she was leaving. She wasn't that young. But she said, I just need to be on my own. And then she said, you won't know where I am because these letters will come to you if I write anymore from a different place, not where I'm staying. Now, she was and is still a beautiful girl. And as a father, you can imagine what went through my mind. Oh, the danger that she's in, and how will I even know? She won't be revealing that she's my daughter, and I have found trouble sleeping. About once a month, we actually got a letter from her, and then after about 4 months, we never heard any more. And I wondered, oh, God, what's happened? You know, you read the paper, you try to find out, is there anyone, you know, anybody that's been found or what have you. It was a time of great agony for us. Now, one pastor's conference at Calvary Costa Mesa, my wife and I and some friends were seated kind of two-thirds of the way back at Calvary Costa Mesa, and everyone else had left the auditorium because we were still pondering what had been said and talking to one another about it. And I saw a friend of mine, a well-known person, a lady from this basin, this Los Angeles basin, come walking over toward me with purpose, you know, written on her face. And she sat down behind us, and her husband also, and kind of exhaled and said, you have a daughter named such and such, don't you? And she had my complete attention because she named that daughter. I said, yes. She said, I know where she is. She said, she's pregnant. And she said, I'm violating laws and I'm violating really my ethics in telling you this. But I know how I would feel if I were in your place and she's about to have a child that you would never see. And she said, all I will tell you is that she's in such and such a town in California. I said, thank you. She said, if you can protect my name, please do. I said, I will, don't worry. So immediately my wife and I jumped into our car because it wasn't a big town and we knew she drove a little red Honda, you know, the little ones from way back. And you can find those if you drive enough around town. And we headed for that town, and just to shorten the story, it discovered that She lived just one block away from the hotel we had checked into. And so we got back in touch with her, and it was a wonderful reunion. And she had grown an awful lot, not just in size, but as a person in that time. And she wept and she said, "Dad, I didn't want to hurt your reputation." I said, "Honey, you can't hurt my reputation more than I've already hurt my reputation. We just love and value you, you know." And as it all worked out, she came back home, and actually she got married while she was up there, not to the father of the child, but to someone else. And I said to my congregation, I said, "You know, I told them they could here in Southern California live 10 blocks away and they would be in a different world. And whatever church they went to, they would think, well, here's a neat couple with a little baby that have come to our place. This is great." But she said, "No, we want to come back here." So I said to the congregation, "You know, we can accept them or reject them. We can show the love of God to them or we can be distant. I just know what I'm going to do." And they received them with absolutely open arms and hearts. But here's another thing that happened out of this, and I haven't yet told you where my altar is, have I? It may surprise you. But I found out I didn't know my congregation after all, because person after person came up to me afterward weeping and saying, "Oh man, you know, my father forced me to abort a child back when I was a teenager. And oh man, I wish that you had been my dad back then and had loved me and accepted me as you have done here with your daughter," and so forth. And story after story after story like that was shared with me, weeping. And I thought, you know, God, what an incredible memorial. But my altar and the place that I always think of when I think of this story is that pew we were sitting in at Costa Mesa. Now they've redecorated the place. And it looks better, but it doesn't have that pew. But there's a little more to the story. There's another altar. Years ago, I was doing a spiritual emphasis week in Billings, Montana, at a Southern Baptist Bible college way up north. Yeah, it's interesting. And as part of my time there, I was invited to speak at a place called Yellowstone Ranch. Now, that's its name, but it back in my day, we called that a reform school, a place where young boys whose lives had gone awry but were still beneath the age of majority, or 18 or 21 actually. It would have been 18 at that time. And it was a Christian place. And they sent kids there from a number of different towns. And you know, Chicago sent a lot of people there. But it being a Christian place, one of the things that they really wanted to do were to win those guys to the Lord. Now, they had to follow the rules. They couldn't force them to go to chapel, but they would invite them, and, oh, kids were getting saved right and left in that place, and it was wonderful. But it had a problem because, like, Chicago would send people constantly to check on the kids they had there, and they'd find out, man, they're doing good. Why? Because they got saved, but they couldn't tell them that. Say, "We'll take them home now." "No, we got to disciple them." He couldn't say that either. But I spoke at chapel in that place, and I'll never forget, they had built a little altar in the middle of the room made of stones, kind of like God had told them to. And when it was graduation time for one of those young men, and he was about to go back home, there at that place, they would pray for them and have them go to that altar and pick out a stone. They'd say, "Keep it in your pocket. And anytime you're in temptation or anytime you're struggling with your place with God, just keep that stone there and let it be a little altar that you carry in your pocket to remind you." Now, part of what moves me about this is that they ask me, because I was only going to be there that last day. Would you also take a stone from this and remember us and pray for us? And also use it the way those kids will. Oh, I will. Now, here's where it gets rather interesting. My daughter that I just told you about had a daughter and a son, and the son was a real problem. And when finally here in Southern California, his action caused the state to take over his life, we as a family were praying, oh God, please let him send him to a place that will be a Christian place. And with our independent investigation, it was really remarkable. As a family, we came together and we all had come to the same conclusion. Oh God, somehow let us get him to Yellowstone Ranch. You know what? I can't begin to tell you the kind of cartwheels we all wanted to do when the state announced to us, we've decided to send him to Yellowstone Ranch. Yeah! Because I knew what would happen there and what they would do. He's 18 now and he's back down here, and God has really helped him in the course of that. But now I want to take you just to last Wednesday. I was speaking at the Midwest Pastors Conference in Indiana, and I told that story about my grandson and about Yellowstone Ranch. Now, there was there in the congregation a young man who had a really tough time. His dad, who was a pastor, had died just a few years earlier, and it was just total shock to all of us. And none of us had quite gotten over his death, because he had been one of the worship leaders for that conference and a phenomenal songwriter and just loved by everybody. And his son hadn't done so well and had gone off into a different life and drugs and so forth. But he had come back, and I didn't know that, and was now one of the directors of U-Turn for Christ out there. And that had been a major part of his life. And after I told that story, and I had turned the congregation loose to do what I'm about to turn you loose to do, by that point I was kind of just blubbering too much, and I turned away and I went to the back of the stage behind some of the sound equipment. And this young fellow found me there, and he came up and he said, I've got to share something with you. He said, my mother just handed me yesterday before I came down here something she had found of my dad's possession that I didn't know existed, but it was a small bag of rocks. And he said, I've brought them with me. I consider it kind of a precious memorial to my dad. And he said, I'd like to give you this rock to remind you of what God has done for me and for my dad, and what effect you had on my dad in coming out to these conferences. And so here's a little altar that I carry in my pocket as of last Wednesday. You know? Well, you've heard some of mine, and the thing is, every one of you have some point you remember where God did something in your life. It's almost like we can remember, if you're old enough, when Kennedy was assassinated. I know exactly where I was. I remember it. And you can remember where you were on 9/11. I do. I just can't remember where I was yesterday, that's all. But you have some points in your life where you know, thank you, God, I'll never forget that. That becomes a little altar point for you. And here's what I want you to do now. I want you to take just a few minutes, if you will, and with someone here, if you're seated next to your wife or your husband, and if you're both here, I hope you are, maybe you want to share with each other. Maybe you'd like to go to someone else and share this particular point, this altar point in your life. I wanted to just take time to do that as a sharing of that memorial, as a witness, if you please, like that altar was back in Joshua chapter 22. Now, at the end of that, there will be pastors down here. Our worship team will be playing a little bit. And if you wish to have prayer, that will happen. We want you to know that here is a place where we believe that God hears and answers prayer and that He interferes benevolently in our lives. And if you feel like I need some benevolence from God tonight, don't hesitate to come and be prayed for. And don't hesitate to just enjoy worshiping the Lord too during this time. So, have you got your instructions now? Right now, I want you to just take a moment and share with someone an altar in your life. It doesn't have to be the biggest one, but just one that you just say, that I'll always remember as a place where God did a wonderful, wonderful thing for me. Got it? All right, go.